Welcome to McClanahan Academy's course on American Constitutions. This is the first presentation of the course, and what you're going to find over the next 40 presentations is a discussion of American constitutions from the earliest origins up until the present day. And in that, we're going to talk about in detail the United States Constitution, the Articles of Confederation, the Confederate States Constitution. We're also going to look at American case law and how the Supreme Court influenced the interpretation of the Constitution, but also the original Constitution, and how the men who wrote it and ratified it wanted it to be interpreted as well. So this is going to be a comprehensive course on the thorough history of American constitutions, including state constitutions, which I did not mention as well. So I hope that you're ready for this. Again, 40 lectures. It's the longest course I've done for McClanahan Academy to this point. And we're going to start actually before the United States was even the United States. We have to go back to Greece, Rome, and England to look at the origins of American constitutions. So let's get started with that. So one of the main questions we're going to answer in this particular course and this particular presentation is, where did our form of government originate? We often think about the United States as being an experiment, that we're unique. You have that idea of American exceptionalism, but is all that true? Now, people believe it, and I think there is a case to be made about American exceptionalism. But when you talk about American government, you wouldn't have American government without a firm basis in Western civilization. This is when John Dickinson stood up, and one of the reasons why John Dickinson stood up in the Philadelphia Convention, and said that experience must be our only guide. Reason may mislead us. That quote really captures the American constitutional tradition, whether it's at the general government, the level of general government, the state level, whether we're talking about the U.S. Constitution, the Articles of Confederation, or the Confederate States Constitution. Now, the Supreme Court is a little different story, and when we look at different constitutional traditions, I'll talk about that here in just a second, we have a real problem in America with determining how we should follow the Constitution and what Constitution should we follow. But when you look at where our government came from, where our system of government came from, you have to go back to the beginnings of Western civilization, and particularly the Greeks and the Romans. In fact, there's a wonderful book, and I'm going to show it to you. And it's one of your books that I recommend you read, but it's Carl Richard, The Founders and the Classics, Greece, Rome, and the American Enlightenment. And he followed that up with another book entitled Greeks and Romans Bearing Gifts, How the Ancients Inspired the Founding Fathers. Now, we know a few things about the founding generation. Of course, I wrote about them in my Politically Incorrect Guide to the Founding Fathers. The Founding Fathers Guide to the Constitution is one of your required texts for this course. So I enjoy writing about that particular part of American history. And we know that they were well-versed in Greek and Roman history. They read the Greek political philosophers in Greek. They read the Greek and Roman histories in Greek and Latin. So their classical education was extremely important in the development of their worldview, whether it came from, or whether it was in regard to government or moral philosophy, political philosophy. You have this idea perpetuated by people like Gordon Wood and Bernard Bailyn. It's often called the soft theory of the founders, that they were enlightened thinkers. And of course, even Richard says this is the American Enlightenment, and that the Enlightenment, the Age of Reason, had a tremendous impact on the founding generation. And certainly I think you can go back and look at parts of their beliefs and see that the Enlightenment does have an impact there. But more than anything else, I think the dominant figures in the founding generation, people that you don't often hear about, we know about the Big Six, we know about Jefferson and Adams and Washington and Hamilton and Franklin and Madison, we know about them. But people like John Dickinson or Roger Sherman or John Rutledge, these individuals, these people, had as much influence on the direction of America as any of those Big Six. And of course, it wasn't always the Enlightenment that they were interested in. It was a conservative tradition that they were interested in. That conservative tradition involved the Greeks and Romans. It also involved English history, and we'll talk about that too. In fact, the founders often referenced Greek and Roman history in debate, and they understood the American colonies and later the United States to be part of a long history of government in Western civilization. They could recite these people off the top of their head and experiences they had. And of course, sometimes this was criticized. I didn't know we were going to Greek history today. But more than not, the reason they used those examples is because they were firm examples of the problems of government in human society. The Greeks, whether it was Aristotle or Plato, or you look at all the different thinkers in classical Greece and all the different experiences in classical Greece, the Greeks understood government and human nature as well as anybody in Western civilization. And so if you're looking for examples, we know that people will do X, Y, and Z because people did these things. History is a long train of examples. We know that because these people did these things. So if you're going back and you're looking at the origins of government, you have to go back to Greece. You have to go to Rome. And you find that corruption is one thing the founders were greatly concerned about. The problems of corruption. The problems of power. How you reconcile power. How you check power. Well, this is where you get the idea of checks and balances. What entities are going to be able to check power? Is it just going to be different branches of government, or will it be the states, which is why you have the Senate? We're going to talk about all these things in the course. What about the executive branch? Can it protect itself? This is why you have the veto, which is Latin for I forbid. It comes from Roman antecedents. What about the secular rule of law? Law that is not governed by theology. Now, we know that in Massachusetts, you certainly had a theocracy in the colonial period. Perhaps even in Pennsylvania with the Quakers. But more than anything else, the founders understood what religion and law together could do, which was not always beneficial. So they were more interested in a secular rule of law. That didn't mean they were irreligious. It didn't mean they were opposed to religion. It didn't mean they were opposed to religion in society or even in public pronouncements. But what it did mean is they didn't want a theocracy. All of these things have their origins in either Greek or Roman society. The secular rule of law in particular when it comes to Rome. We're also going to talk about things like written and unwritten constitutions. There are two traditions that conflict with each other in America. One is the American tradition of a written constitution. That is almost purely an American tradition. The other is the British tradition of an unwritten constitution. Now, that British tradition of an unwritten constitution is important. It's very important because this is essentially how the federal court system works. And so that can create problems for the written constitution. So we have two different teams playing two different games on two different fields, and we expect these two things to reconcile. We expect these two things to work together, and in some cases they do work, but oftentimes they come into conflict with each other because if we're going to have an unwritten constitution, we're going to rely on the courts. You're simply going to pass legislation, rely on the courts to declare it constitutional or not, whether it's at the federal level, the state level. Well, then why even have a written constitution? The written constitution is there so that the legislators themselves, so the executive branch, so the checks and balances will work. And one entity would say this is unconstitutional, or even the states. And so all those checks and balances are important, but that's part of the written model, which is why we need to understand what that written model means. What about natural rights and civil liberties? Do Americans have natural rights? You look at the Declaration. We'll talk about the Declaration. This idea that we have inalienable rights, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, or life, liberty, and property, which, of course, everyone knew pursuit of happiness meant property. But are those things, is there a conception of natural rights? Does that actually exist? What about civil liberties? Where do these liberties come from? Do they come from a higher power, as in a natural right, or do they come from the government? There are those who believe they come from the government. There are those who believe they don't. And of course, all of these things can be influenced by political philosophy, whether it's the Greeks, the Romans, the Renaissance, which produced the Enlightenment. The Enlightenment was very interested in natural rights. Catholic theologians were also interested in natural rights. But these are philosophical questions when you start looking at the role and proper nature and proper role of government in American society. And they're all questions that we're going to be addressing throughout this course. So I bring them up here. This is not going to be the last time you hear about these different issues. We'll bring them up again when we get to, say, the Bill of Rights. and discussing there. We'll discuss some of these things again with the Declaration. We'll discuss some of these issues. We'll discuss written and unwritten constitutions again. These are important things, particularly near the end of the course. We'll get into that in more detail. Now, a couple of quotes here, and these are from Carl Richard himself and the founders in the classics. First, quote, "The founders had access to every level of this Western tradition of mixed government theory. Hence, it was only natural that when confronted by unprecedented parliamentary taxation during the 1760s and 1770s, they should turn to the most ancient and revered of political theories to explain this perplexing phenomenon." And then again, Richard, quote, "The framers of the new state constitutions, which emerged from the Revolution, never doubted that their government should be mixed. Rather, their real dilemma was how to mix them in a society which no longer possessed a monarch and which had never possessed a titled aristocracy." This gets into this idea of Jefferson and Adams and the natural aristocracy. The founders certainly believed, across the board, I think, for the most part, in a natural aristocracy. An aristocracy that would rise simply because of talent. They didn't care for an artificial aristocracy, but they did believe in an aristocracy nevertheless. But that one would come from talent, and it would make itself apparent over time. But again, going back to Richard, I use these quotes because it's a nice example of the fact that the founders are looking for examples outside of even Great Britain at times to understand what was happening in America and looking for examples on how to craft a constitution. Because the British didn't have a written constitution. Something has to be written, and you have to look for examples. So let's start with Greece. One of the questions is about Greece. Did the Spartan constitution influence other Western constitutions? Now, if you're not familiar with the Spartan constitution, it's often considered to be a mixed constitution. The Spartan lawgiver named Lycurgus was one who was supposedly the man who wrote the Spartan constitution. And if you look at that constitution, they had a dual monarchy, which was checked by a group of people called ephors. Those ephors were elected by the popular assembly, the arms-bearing citizens of Sparta. Above that, you had a council of elders, which would actually initiate legislation, but the assembly itself, the popular assembly, could veto that legislation. They also had the potential to declare peace and war, and they had control over the monarch through these ephors. Now, the other thing, the monarch did lead the army and had religious functions. But all of this, there were checks and balances, and you had a mixed constitution of essentially oligarchy, democracy, and monarchy. Now, the question is, did that constitution really ever exist? Historians debate this. We only have evidence of it through oral history. But because that's there, we believe that this constitution did exist in Greece, and it produced a particular type of political culture that was different than, say, in Athens. But certainly, when you're looking for examples back in history of constitutionalism, you have to go back to Greece and even Sparta. Then you have to also talk about Athens. And we know a little bit about Athens because of the volumes of writing that were done about the Athenian government and the Athenian population and culture and society. We know a lot about politics in Greece itself because of Aristotle and his politics. This was a study of over 100 city-states in the Greek world. And Aristotle's conclusion was that we need to find the doctrine of the mean, the moderate, the mix between democracy and oligarchy. Because and monarchy is not always great either. I mean, there's problems with that. Hereditary monarchy in particular produces problems because the son may not be as good as the father. And Aristotle's belief, though, of course, is that small. You had to work from the way up, from the bottom up. Smaller communities better. Plato, of course, in his Republic, has searched for an ideal government as well. Plato was a conservative who was concerned about the influence of democracy and what that would do to a city-state. He had seen it, in his mind, wreck Athens during the Peloponnesian War, so he wanted to avoid that in the future in Athens itself. And the Greeks believed that Monarchy would eventually lead to tyranny, aristocracy eventually oligarchy, and then oligarchy to democracy, which they classified as mob rule. They were not interested in democracy, not the way that Americans seem to be interested in democracy. And to the Athenians and the Spartans and every other person in the Greek world, your city-state, your polis, was your country. You were an Athenian, you were a Spartan, you were a Delian. You were a Theban, and that mattered. Small again. You know, Athens had maybe 60,000 citizens and produced one of the greatest political cultures in the world, in the history of the world. Not just political culture, but culture in general. So, all of these questions factor into America. When the founders talked about decentralization and federalism and all these things, they're thinking of small. They're thinking of the importance of a small state, the size of a republic. A republic in Greece was never more than 500 square miles. You had to be able to walk to the center in a day. It's very important to understand those things. Now, what about Rome? The founding generation also found other examples to emulate and focused on Rome, with its republican origins, strong citizen rule, and mixed government. The fact that Rome lasted for a long period of time also factored into their opinions on Roman constitutionalism. And more than anything, I think you can say that the founders' admiration for Rome had much to do with their respect for the early Roman citizen and for its conservative tendencies, a distrust of democracy, a support for the rule of law, a support for ancestral customs. All the founders supported their ancestral customs in their own state. I mean, New Englanders were staunchly New Englanders, and they didn't believe that they needed to be Southerners. And Southerners, the same thing, and those from New York and Pennsylvania, same thing. They had fierce allegiance to their traditions and customs, their political culture of their communities. Also, the founders would learn from this that there's problems with corruption, there's problems with plutocracy, there's problems with egalitarian reforms, the Gracchi, and what happened with them. Corruption was something they worried about over and over again. They worried about the power of the imperium. If the executive had the imperium, meaning that's the civil and military power, that could create problems for the population. They took veto from the tribal assembly. They understood they took the term Senate from the Roman Senate. The first citizen. The idea that, when you look at the early empire and you start talking about Augustus, he considered himself to be the first citizen. That was the title he preferred, princeps, or first citizen. Because that's what he thought of himself as, the first citizen of Rome. And if you look at the president of the United States, that's the idea behind it. The president's the first citizen of the United States. And that certainly has Roman antecedents. Now, what about the English and British models? So, one thing that's interesting, when you go back and you look at the medieval period in England, and you have William the Conqueror, of course, he became King of England in 1066, and you look at, near the end of his life, he commissioned a book called the Domesday Book. This is a census for the purposes of taxation. But what you find in this book is that most towns, most villages in Great Britain, or at this time, England, not Great Britain yet, but England, most villages had maybe 100 people in them. 100 people. There was a local self-government tradition. You had local lawgivers. You had the sheriff. There was a tradition in England of local self-government. And, of course, armed resistance to tyranny. And that manifested itself at the Magna Charta of 1215. The barons at Runnymede forced the king to sign, King John Lackland to sign the Magna Carta because he loses. But this was an assertion of what Patrick Henry later called the ancient constitutions of the English. And a couple of things came out of this. No one's above the law, not even the king. The king can be compelled by force to obey the law. And kings cannot collect or levy taxes without the consent of an advisory council, later called Parliament. Except customary taxes, but not new taxes. Kings can't do it without Parliament saying, yeah, you can do this. This is experience being our only guide here. This is what Dickinson's talking about. Here's the experience. That Magna Carta said this, quote, "We have also granted to all freemen of our kingdom, for us and our heirs forever, all the underwritten liberties to be had and held by them and their heirs for us and our heirs forever." For us and our heirs forever, freemen of our kingdom. Freemen, now it doesn't say, if you're not freemen, you don't have these. But the liberties, again, these liberties are asserted. King John's forced to sign this thing. The liberties are asserted, and they're defended. And they're not only held by these individuals, they're held by their heirs forever. So if you are a descendant of anyone from this particular period of time, this is your ancestors saying, you have these civil liberties forever because we forced the king to sign this thing. That's a pretty powerful thing. Now, during the English Civil War, the king is challenged. King Charles I is challenged and eventually loses his head. One of the interesting things about that, he actually forced himself into Parliament at one point and tried to take a couple of members out by force, and he was denied. And now the ceremony involving the monarchy in England involves a situation where the Queen, at this point, will ask to make a speech, and she'll invite the House of Commons, and they will slam the door in her representative's face because this shows their independence. They're not going to be tied to the King or the Queen. Now, that civil war ended in the Restoration. It ended in the Protectorate for a time, then the Restoration. And at the end of that Restoration, King James II was on the throne, and it was assumed he was a Catholic. He was right about that. And the British or English people at this point wanted him off the throne. Part of that was a new Bill of Rights. The English Bill of Rights, which is similar in form to the Declaration of Independence. It outlined English civil liberties. It outlined the rights of Englishmen, which had been established by centuries of custom and precedent, going back to 1200. But remember, this does not produce a written constitution. This produces an unwritten British constitution. And the imperial structure, as we're going to see, is very important for understanding the conflict between the American colonies and the British themselves. But that unwritten British constitution is so important. In some ways, it allows individuals to have some wiggle room. And we'll look at this when we get to the Ninth Amendment to the U.S. Constitution and some other things. But certainly, this is a different kind of model than what we have in the United States. Some would say a better model, some would say a worse model, but it's certainly a different kind of model. And I actually had one quote-unquote conservative commentator tell me one time that the British don't have a constitution. Yes, they do. It's all the case law. That's their constitution. So the first part of the English Bill of Rights is an indictment of King James II. He's cruel. He inflicts cruel and unusual punishment. Now think, where have we seen that before? Oh yeah, the Eighth Amendment. He imposes excessive fines. Again, Bill of Rights. He keeps a standing army in time of peace without consent of Parliament, and he quarters soldiers contrary to law. Grave concern of the founding generation was a standing army. A grave concern. And it's something we're going to talk about when we get to that part of the Constitution. But here we have the English talking about it in 1688. So according to the English Bill of Rights, James II was acting against the Constitution, also custom and precedents which had been established by English law. Now the second part of the document established civil liberties with some of the language adopted by later American documents. Quote, that it is the right of the subjects to petition the king and all commitments and prosecutions for such petitioning are illegal. This, of course, is the First Amendment. That the raising or keeping a standing army without the king within the kingdom in a time of peace, unless it be with the consent of Parliament, is against the law. Wow. Can't even have a standing army unless the Parliament says it's okay. That the subjects, which are Protestants, may have arms for the defense suitable to their condition and is allowed by law. So this is expanding the ability for people to own firearms. Important. That election of members of parliament ought to be free. I mean, that goes without saying, but it seemed they had to spell this out. That the freedom of speech in debates or proceedings in parliament ought not to be impeached or questioned in any court or place out of parliament. This is the same kind of protection American congressmen have today. Same kind of protection. And last but not least, that excessive bail ought not to be required, nor excessive fines imposed, nor cruel and unusual punishments inflicted. So those are all important things to get out of the English Bill of Rights. And you look at those liberties at the end. We'll talk about these things again when we get to the United States Constitution and the Bill of Rights. But until then, I want you to read Mel Bradford's A Better Guide Than Reason, also the two books I mentioned by Carl Richard. That is a good place to start, something you should be doing, reading your material. It'll help you keep up with the class. It'll help you keep up with what I'm talking about. And until next time, we're going to get into presentation two next time. So until next time, I'll see you then.